You're listening to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture.
My name's Stephen Charlton. I'm the Principal Managing Director for Perkins & Will in our London office.
And I'm Owen Wainhouse.
It's very different now. I mean, London's changed so much in the 10 years that I've been away. It's almost like being in a time capsule. You know, you go away and, you know, the words that you'd used and the sort of slang that you hear in the streets and just the level of development, it's quite alien, actually.
Our guest this week is the designer Stephen Charlton. In 2008, in the midst of the global financial crisis, Stephen launched the Middle East office of Pringle Brandon, the architecture and corporate interiors firm founded in London by Chris Brandon and former RIBA president Jack Pringle. Stephen grew the Dubai office from an initial 2 people to over 100 members of staff. Pringle Brandon subsequently merged with America's third largest architecture firm, Perkins & Will, in 2012, with the London and Dubai offices becoming known initially as Pringle Brandon Perkins & Will, and later simply Perkins & Will. But in November 2017, Stephen returned to London to become managing principal of Perkins & Will's now 130-strong London office. With the clear aim of repeating his success in the Middle East and growing the architecture side of the business in London. In this week's episode, we talk about the names of architecture firms and the legacy of their founders. We talk about how things change when you double the size of your office and then double again. We talk about corporate interiors and large-scale architecture, and also hear about Perkins & Will's latest acquisition of the Danish architecture firm Schmidt & Alassen. But I started by asking Stephen about his move back to London.
So you moved back to London October?
It was the 1st of November.
1st of November.
Yeah, after 10 years in the Middle East, in Dubai and Abu Dhabi.
And you joined Perkins & Will in their... Well, I mean, it was Pringle Brandon. Was it the firm
that
you originally joined?
Yeah, it was. Well, we set... Myself and my sort of business partner, a lady called Di Thorson, we set it up probably about 8 years ago. So there was just the two of us. And
We established it in Dubai.
Yeah, okay. I think everybody else was running for the hills or running back to another country.
Was that 2007?
It was a little bit later than that. So I think it was the end of 2008, early 2009. Okay.
So properly in that global financial crisis.
Into it.
So you thought now's a good time to...
to start something new. Yeah. I think we would... You know what? It's a really good time to start up a new business because you don't have any legacy issues. You don't, you know, people don't owe you money and you don't owe them money.
Yeah.
So it's a clean slate almost. So in many ways, it was a good time to set it up.
Right. And you'd been then before Pringle Brandon, you'd been in the Middle East before.
I'd been there for maybe 3 years before doing that. So I worked in a big design firm, a local firm in the region. And I think they had about 1,000 staff at one point, doing some sort of contracting as well and building things like the Abu Dhabi Formula One.
Yeah.
But then when the market crashed, everything came falling down.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Very quickly as well.
Yeah. And what led you then?
My ex-wife actually was brought up in the Middle East.
Right.
So her father was a pilot. All her sort of extended family were there. So we went over there on holidays to see family.
Okay.
And I just saw all this construction going on. And it was just, well, you know, we've got a new baby, so this is a good time to move.
Okay.
I remember going for a job interview in London, actually.
Yeah.
And then I was offered the job the next day, and then they wanted me to be there like ASAP, like within a week if I could be. So it was all
so
very quick.
Interviewed for the job, for your original job in London.
In London.
Okay.
Yeah.
Then, so you'd been then, and that was Dubai rather than Abu Dhabi.
That was Dubai. Yeah, that was Dubai.
And so you kind of knew the city well enough to.
I'd explored a few times. I had seen all the construction. You know, there was so much going on at the time, even in comparison to where it is now. I think at that time it was the real boom time.
Right. So your kind of route then into design, you studied at Edinburgh College of Art.
That's right,
Before then, what was that kind of route?
I guess In school, I always had a passion for design. I guess if you go back further, with my grandfather, we used to draw pictures of more like industrial design or product design. We would draw pictures of airplanes or cars or whatever it was. And then it's at school, it was the same. I had a passion for design. I didn't know what sort of design. I just knew I liked drawing things and designing things. The typical kids who pulls apart, you know, the VCR players and tries to put it back together again, but can't. So I think I was obviously meant to do something in that industry.
That's interesting. That kind of early product design, maybe.
Yeah, it was. And then I went to after school. I went to Newcastle College of Art, where it was sort of a foundation course.
Yeah.
And in foundation, obviously, you do multiple sort of disciplines. And interiors was the one I loved. For some reason, I just loved doing the interiors part of it.
Okay.
More so than anything else.
So you then studied at Edinburgh, that was interior design and architecture.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
And that was
great. I loved Edinburgh.
Undergrad.
Yeah.
And you're not, where are you from? Where's the kind of family?
It's Northumberland. So it's a place called Morpeth. But, you know, I think when you're in the Middle East, you try and explain what that is, and it's impossible. So you just say Newcastle.
Right.
Still impossible sometimes. North of London.
Okay. I mean, maybe that's...
Exactly.
That's what you say to a lot of Londoners still, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. The North. My wife finds it very amusing when we drive up to the North. She's been watching Game of Thrones, and she just thinks about that all the time.
So 3 years then in Edinburgh.
Yes.
Studying as an undergrad.
Yes.
And then you didn't go on to do part two.
No, it was pure. It was many interiors and a bit of furniture design there as well.
Okay.
And after that, it was a weird one. Actually, the first year I was there, I was just experiencing university life and just having fun. And then in the final sort of 2 years. I'd spoken to my lecturers, and I really wanted to do well in this. And by the end of it, I won lots of awards, got sort of the highest grades, and it became a passion, I guess, something I was really intensely wanting to do. And after that, I went back home for a bit, spent some time with family, and I worked in a local practice, which was fine. But part of that was research into what best practice was within other sort of international firms.
Okay.
So I came down to London and I met lots of sort of the big international firms. And then I was offered a job by one of them. So I actually worked at HLW, which is not too far away, another sort of American firm that seems to follow me now.
And so you'd lived then in London before for a while?
I did 2 years. I was in South London, in Clapham, which was fantastic. But it's very different now. I mean, London's changed so much in the 10 years that I've been away.
Yeah.
It's almost like being in a time capsule. You know, you go away and, you know, the words that you'd used and the sort of slang that you hear in the streets and just the level of development, it's quite alien, actually.
And in Dubai, the kind of English, it's when I spent 6 years in Brussels and kind of found my English getting worse and kind of turning into what they called the Euro English.
Yes.
You kind of adopt, you know, kind of lack of idioms and a kind of.
Yeah.
English predominantly the working language.
Yeah. I mean, I don't sound Northumbrian anymore. So it's clearly been influenced by my time in Dubai.
Okay.
My business partner, she was she is South African.
Right.
So we sat next to each other for 7 years.
Yeah.
So you pick up inflections from that.
Yeah.
My wife's American. So obviously I'm picking up sort of tomato and rolling tomato and all the arguments about what came first.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting then you've not, I mean, so Pringle Brandon and then Perkins & Will, huge kind of architecture firm, which you led in the Middle East and now leading in London.
Yeah.
But not yourself.
I'm not an architect.
Not as an architect.
Exactly.
So,
and I don't do any interiors either anymore.
Right.
So it's...
So you kind of developed that skill for managing a big practice.
Yes.
It's what, 130-odd?
130, 140, something like that. Okay. I think Dubai, we grew it from, say, two of us to maybe 100 in the space of about 5 years. So
you'd say as a title, kind of job title, as managing director.
Yeah.
It kind of sounds more like a kind of a corporate... It's a huge firm now, Perkins & Will, kind of around the
It world. Is, and I think, you know,
Is it a business discipline, do you think, that's kind of brought into the firm?
I think it is. I think it was interesting. So Jack Pringle was obviously my mentor. Mm. And he always said, every time you double the size of a business, the structure changes.
Yeah.
So, you know, when we were, you know, 10 people, it was all hands a deck. So yeah. I was designing and I was presenting and I was doing extremely late nights and doing what everybody else does.
Yeah.
Once you get to sort of the 20 number, you have to pull away a little bit from that. And again, 50 changes again. Yeah. And once you're at 100s, it's really difficult to be designing.
Yeah.
I mean, I think in Perkins & Will, we don't have many managing directors who are still design directors.
Right.
There's a couple,
okay. Yeah.
But in reality, it's a full-time job, just yeah. managing yeah. people and yeah. you know, making decisions and trying to have an overview of everything that's mm. going on, but trying to know enough about each of the disciplines that you can have an informed conversation,
yeah.
either with clients yeah. or with the team.
So you're not bringing in a managing director from another kind of discipline who
no,
doesn't know anything
exactly.
about
that. So, kind of... yeah. So I have to know, that was quite a fast learning curve. I had to know about yeah. hospitality really quickly.
Yeah.
I had to know about who we were doing a football stadium.
Yeah.
I had to understand sort of the FIFA guidelines. All these things that you don't think you'll need to know, you just have to, you have to be able to be confident enough to have discussions about it, but admit that you're not the expert. Because that will come across completely the wrong way.
It's, yeah.
you know, I understand the business and the teams and the structure, and I have experts who I
yeah.
can bring to come and meet you, so they can deliver the project.
And that's, I mean, I suppose there's something about that being really clear to you in your job description
yeah.
and your kind of role that you're not.
Yeah.
You know, I guess that's something
yeah.
people who have grown their own smaller practice into a bigger practice.
It might
maybe
be hard.
Kind of struggle with to
yeah,
pull away
it might
and
be.
Not be.
Yeah.
involved day to day in that.
Yeah, exactly.
That
yeah.
Do you miss that then? I mean, do you kind of,
I probably missed it maybe 5 years ago.
Okay.
When it was fresher.
Yeah.
Now I enjoy seeing young talents become successful in design.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
more interesting for me, weirdly.
Yeah.
I never felt I was the best designer. You know, I did well. I got good grades, and
yeah.
you know, I won projects. But I never saw myself as a leading design talent.
Yeah.
Especially when I see other people now, who I see is really are
yeah.
exceptionally talented at what they do.
And that's really hard then. I mean, thinking about recruitment. I mean, I'm not an architect, and
mm.
I kind of wouldn't. I mean, I guess when you're recruiting,
mm.
you know, and trying to kind of bring in, there's
yeah.
obviously a challenge to bring in the best talent in
yes.
a big firm
yes.
with the size of this. How do you kind of assess that in interview or portfolio? How do you,
I mean,
presumably fairly involved in
yeah,
recruitment.
Yeah, of course.
To the firm,
I think the more senior the staff, then obviously the more I get involved,
yeah.
Or the more critical the role, the
yeah.
more I would get involved. So the recruitment, I guess I look for different things. In some ways, maybe I sometimes pretend if I'm the client and that person's in front of me, how would I feel about that? And how do I think they perform in that sort of aspect?
Yeah.
In terms of the technical and the creative sides,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to rely on sort of my team
yeah.
to review that. I want to empower the team to make those decisions,
right.
But it's almost another angle to have a look at it.
Yeah.
You know, many times I think I've seen, you know, I don't go and officially review work, but if I see work up and think from a client perspective, does that make sense?
Yeah.
I would talk to the team about it.
Because
yeah. often we think too often about what we want rather
yeah.
than what the client
yeah.
actually wants.
And that then, presumably, that's been, I mean, that sort of managerial
mm.
skill is not taught in design school in that
yeah.
sense. So that's learned, I guess, partly from Jack.
It's partly from Jack, exactly. I think having a mentor is obviously
yeah.
a great thing. I do think it's intuitive,
yeah.
weirdly.
Yeah.
There's an element of risk that you have to make a decision because somebody ultimately has to make a decision.
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, in hindsight, that was easier to do as we grew a practice because
yeah.
you're making decisions on a smaller, you know, on a smaller risk profile. It's
yeah.
two people, it's 10 people.
Yeah.
I think if you were to come into a job into managing director of a big 100-person firm and you
yeah.
didn't have that experience, then that might be challenging.
Yeah. One decision, yeah. £100 million.
Exactly. So the weight isn't so heavy on you at that
yeah.
point when it's only a few people.
And then I'm interested a little bit in the practice has been through, and we talked about the kind of the mergers. You've recently, as
yes.
a firm, merged. Now we might come
mm.
on to that kind of later on with
yeah.
a big Danish practice.
Yes.
and then the name change, obviously, from Pindle Brangden to the four, yes. four names, and then to Perkins and Will. I mean, Perkins and Will founded in the States, obviously, big American firm.
Big American firm, long, long time ago as well.
Perkins and yes. Philip Will.
Yes.
It's sort of interesting there. I mean, I guess one of the things about architecture firms who are very well known originally by the names of their founders. Yes. Yeah, a lot of architecture firms have those names in there. And then sometimes I think it may be HOK or SOM, start moving away from. Yeah.
It's an interesting topic, actually. I think, you know, there's obviously, we've been in an era of sort of the superstar architects.
Yeah.
But there was a previous era of superstar architects.
Yeah.
And what happens after that person isn't there? And essentially, they turn into a commercial practice where other people come in and you have to run the business and you have to, you know, there's an element of legacy where you'll still win work based on the previous name of the person that was there. But over time, that fades away because that person's no longer there.
Yeah.
So I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens as we move forward in the next 10, 20 years, particularly in the UK, actually, where there's a lot of very strong named practices. And what happens to them? Do they become just, you know, the acronyms, or what happens?
Yeah. It seems we were talking to Ken Shuttleworth a couple of weeks ago about Make and his decision deliberately to start from the very from that kind of process without his name on the on the practice. And then, I mean, is there a kind of an identity or a legacy of those types of buildings? You know, as you become a more corporate practice, maybe. Does that stay within the practice, the kind of style of buildings? I mean, there's obviously a big legacy.
Yeah. I think for Perkins and Will, the legacy's certainly been sort of the higher education where we started, or the K-12, and into the healthcare field.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, that in reality, you have to define who you're going to be in the future. And I think particularly for our London office, you know, who are we? And, you know, what do we stand for? What do we believe in? But not on a global perspective. What do we believe in on a local perspective?
Mm.
I think that's really important.
And then how much, you know, your kind of offices, obviously in the States, Middle East, London, how much do you think of yourself as a kind of as a big global practice then when you're kind of talking to clients and you know, a client's coming to the London office, they're coming to the kind of, because of the big kind of corporate.
Like, I think it's hard to get away from it sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, you come to our office and it's clearly a big office and it's all been done properly. So there's a sense of arrival in a space like that. I think a lot of major developers and major clients feel comfortable that we can service them, but also we're not going to go anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, we're a big firm. So that's reassuring to them as well. For me, it's fantastic to be a big firm, but we have to... have an identity and a place in each location that we're in. You know, I think London's somewhat easier in a way, because London's an established city. Dubai was a very transient country, so people come for 2 years, 5 years, and they move, and you know that none of the staff are going to be there forever. Whereas in London, some staff could be here for 20 years, 30 years. Some staff have been for 20, 30 years. So it's a different challenge, I guess.
Yeah. Okay. And then maybe, I mean, that's interesting. I'll just kind of ask you, maybe say a few words about the kind of merger with, or the kind of acquisition of your Danish colleagues.
SHL.
SHL.
Schmidt-Hammerlassen.
Schmidt-Hammerlassen. They've obviously come with a strong... Danish identity.
They have,
and,
yes.
I mean,
it's exciting.
Yeah.
Okay. They're an exciting firm.
And will they continue to kind of operate as a standalone?
That's the plan.
The
plan. I think, I mean, Perkins & Will are a firm of acquisitions.
Yeah.
So it feels like every year there is an acquisition, whether it's Portland, who are just next door.
Yeah.
I don't know who else. I think we bought a firm in Denver recently, maybe about six months ago. So the firm keeps on growing. And SHL are definitely somewhat unique in that they're one of the top Danish firms in terms of design, in terms of architecture, in terms of their output and the recognition they have for the quality of work.
Mm.
So as a firm for Perkins and Will, it's a fantastic addition.
Yeah.
The question is how we merge that.
Yeah.
You know, we have similar practices in other areas.
Mm.
What can we learn from each other? What can we bring to them and what can they bring to us?
Yeah.
And it's great. I mean, I was there probably about a month ago to meet the team. Yeah. We have some team members coming, I think, in 2 days' time as well. So okay. We're starting to have those discussions. Right. And I think because, you know, I went through that merger process 5 years ago, maybe. I sort of understand some of the issues and some of the pitfalls, but also some of the opportunities.
Yeah.
So it's actually a nice way of working because I've already been through it, as of a few other people as well.
Because I guess, there's a lot of change. I guess a lot of people can be uncomfortable or worried about change within those kind of practices and how you sort of look at a corporate identity.
Well, like you said, it's one of the biggest firms in the world, and how, as a smaller firm, how do you see moving into that?
Yeah.
You know, you could get lost quite quickly.
Yeah.
And for us, the challenge is to make sure they don't get lost, and they understand the benefits, and not to take away identity as well. I think that's really important. Yeah. People need to keep their identity and their beliefs and their culture.
Yeah. And that corporate culture, then. I mean, you're headquartered out of.
We're split. So it's. I mean, in reality, the C-suite are based in Atlanta, in Chicago, and Boston and in San Francisco, which in some ways I think it's quite unique, but it also means there's not one power base.
Yeah.
So when you're on a sort of call with the board, they're all in different locations on video conference.
So they're not all whispering in the side of the office and with someone on conference.
Exactly, and I think a lot of other international firms, the power base is in New York or Chicago, and that's the main office.
Yeah.
So we don't really have that, weirdly.
Okay. Devolved kind of power
exactly
base.
So it works it actually works quite well. It was I think at the time nobody from our side really thought about that.
It wasn't planned.
It was just something that we realized over time that actually that's a good thing. Especially when you're not in the US. You don't feel like whatever New York says we have to do, we have to bow down. It's more split up than that.
In a sense, then your relationship with New York, with Atlanta, is the same as New York might be with Atlanta
exactly.
or Chicago.
Yeah, exactly. Because, the people don't see each other on a day-to-day basis. Yeah. They might meet once a month or once a quarter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess that's one of the differences then with, kind of big architecture firms in the States, is there's enough big cities to support big practices.
Yeah.
Whereas here, a couple of big practices, kind of in Manchester maybe, and a couple in Birmingham, but nothing like the kind of scale that London sucks in terms of big practices.
Yeah, we just haven't got that many big cities like the US has.
And then interested in a little bit in, you were talking about identity and about when you were running the office in Dubai, kind of interested really in the kind of culture of architecture and how the kind of day-to-day...
We started the architectural practice when we became Perkins Will, after the acquisition. So that was, say, 5 years ago. And we started from scratch. Now, we didn't have an architect. So we had to go and find somebody to head up the architectural departments, and we had to go and secure work. So by being Perkins and Will, obviously it opens doors. We can go meet certain clients, and we have a portfolio of work. Mm-hmm. But the clients in the Middle East have always said, well, what have you done in the Middle East? Or, who's your team?
Yeah.
How big's your office? These are sort of the questions that they always asked. But over time, we started gaining momentum, and we started winning work. And we got to a stage, I think, we actually won best large architectural firm in the Middle East for 3 years in a row.
Wow.
3 years? Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was 3 years in a row, which was quite unique. But by getting to the stage where we had really top talents, we started to ask the question, well, what is the identity of architecture in the Middle East?
Yeah.
It shouldn't be the fly-in, fly-out approach where... a building looks fantastic in Chicago, so it'll be good in Dubai. Because I think there's lots of examples of that.
Yeah.
And there's also examples where, the architecture hasn't sort of utilized the best practice and, had a look elsewhere. They've just tried to have a go and do something in Dubai, which doesn't quite work either. So it's understanding the culture and the materials, the daylight, all these cultural issues, but trying to use best practice from elsewhere and combining something.
Yeah.
And that's still the challenge for the Middle East. And it's definitely growing. It's getting a lot better. There's some really interesting projects coming out of the ground. But, in London, if you were to say, name me 10 buildings that will never be knocked down, you could name them.
Yeah.
Whereas in Dubai, you couldn't do that.
Right.
Yeah. There's maybe five now.
Yeah.
But and architecturally, they're not probably at the level that you want them to be. It's just that they're iconic. So there's a difference between iconic and legacy, I think, as well. I think Dubai, it is getting better. Recessions help.
Yeah.
Because it focuses the mind and the budget into delivering sort of high quality at a reduced cost.
Yeah. Okay. And the kind of makeup then of staff in the, I mean, maybe that's a sort of similarity with London, the makeup of staff in your Dubai office is partly local, partly international?
Yeah, I mean, we say 100 staff, 27 nationalities. So it's a big, big mix. We do have a few locals there as well. But we have obviously sort of GCC nationals from elsewhere in the Gulf. But it's a huge, huge mix of staff. So the challenge is to bring those cultures together into a way that's not cliquey, and it's, you know, people respect each other. And that was quite hard in the Middle East because a lot of businesses don't work like that in the Middle East. So that's a,
you just
it's
have
a big challenge.
Kind of expatriate international firm.
Exactly. Okay. I think that there's a hierarchy between, you know, people believe certain degrees from certain countries are worth more, and people get paid more depending on where they're from. So there's it's a systematic issue in sort of society there. We never wanted to do that. We wanted to sort of do the opposite and try and create a family where everybody's at the same. You know, it's based on your performance and your skills and your creativity. That's how we sort of made a team, which is, I think, why we were successful.
Okay. And that international makeup then of the practice in Dubai is probably not too dissimilar here, is it?
London's quite similar, actually.
And you think some of the kind of ways of working in Dubai have kind of equipped your
I think, obviously, the speed of design and the speed of decision-making. Well, the speed of design is very quick. The speed of decision-making from the client is very slow.
In Dubai.
That's why we have a problem, because the clients can't make decisions quickly because of the way they structure their businesses. But the deadlines don't change in terms of the end date. So our design has to be quicker. So basically, that's why it happens, I think. But I think there's something to be said about doing things quickly and really focusing on, well, how do we do this quicker than we did it before? The thing that's sort of not shocked me but surprised me is that things take a long, long time in the UK. Part of it's the process, the planning process and everything else, but I think there's no reason why we can't challenge some of these performance and speed issues. It's like a Formula One car, you know, there's room for improvement every year. We can make it a little bit quicker.
Iterative.
Yeah, exactly. We're not going to change the world, but if we look at small pieces every year and try and improve it, then, you know, whether that's technology or whether it's, you know, the way we do something or who knows, but I think we can look at that.
Do you find the kind of speed thing difficult though when you move back to London? Kind of frustrating and just so slow and kind of...
I would. I still walk around really quickly, and I still try and fill my diary full of loads of meetings.
So you keep the speed going.
I'm keeping the speed going.
Okay.
But the pace is it's a big change. Yeah. It really is.
And then I guess the other kind of cultural, you know, for you as a kind of leader of a practice, people talk about this a little bit in China and maybe in the Middle East, is the relationship between business and government then at that level, and how you kind of engage with. I guess identifying where the power lies and who you need to speak to and who you need to.
And it's always very grey. It's really challenging. Yeah, it really is. So I guess that's one thing I've been looking forward to, actually coming back to the UK and, you know, working in sort of jurisdictions which are relatively simple and people understand what the process is. You know, the process might be painful, but at least we know what we're doing and what we have to do then to move forward.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so when you were new to the Middle East, it's a case, is it just of feeling your way? I mean, how do you get yourself into a position where you...
It's sort of, you know, you arrive there and then the first few weeks you think, well, this doesn't make any sense. This is crazy. Everything's frustrating. You know, you want to get your visa done or whatever it is, and you never have the right documents, even though you get told what documents to bring. You've still forgotten one document that they haven't told you about. So it's just lots of frustrations. And then, you know, after 6 months, you start thinking, do I really want to stay here? Is this for me? And I think everybody goes through this period because you miss sort of you miss your friends, your family, you miss things that you're comfortable with, you know, your favorite sort of tea bags or whatever it is. And then after you get past that stage, I think that's when you start to realize that you can't change the Middle East in terms of, you know, you think it should be done X, Y, because that's how you've always done it. Yeah. It doesn't matter. You can't change the whole market to suit yourself. Over time, you can change the market by influencing small pieces and trying to expand it out. I think as a business, that's what we did. We started to really improve the quality and the professionalism of the markets in the Middle East. And I think that's why we were so respected. But you can't do everything all at once. It's going to take you time. I was there 10 years, and it took me a long time to get some movements on some issues.
And then the decision to move back to London, then I kind of will come on to some of the London projects and London work. But was that about just the opportunity for the job in London? Was it about a kind of, if you don't move after 10 years, you'll be here and after another 10
stuck.
Years?
Yeah, maybe. I think me and Jack had been speaking about it for a couple of years in reality. So I think there was always the idea that I would come back and maybe take Jack's position. I think he'd been mentoring me. When things got tricky, I would ask him, you know, what do you think about this? Yeah. And he would help me. So I think I always knew that in the back of my mind that was probably going to happen. The big thing was convincing my wife to move, as she's American, and she's never lived in the UK.
Okay.
So once I convinced her, then we were good to go.
Right, okay. She's not an architect.
She's not, no.
Okay, that's always...
That's a good thing, I think.
So some of the projects then in and around the UK that are kind of, you know, some I guess will be, the practice here, you've moved now to the Whitechapel building.
Yes.
That was what, a couple of years ago,
It wasn't even that. I think it was slightly before me. I think it was March.
Right.
Is that sound right? Yeah, I think it was March.
And that was part of you relocating in two separate teams originally, wasn't it?
The original Bonhill location, they'd been in there for, I don't know, 20 years. Right. There was an affinity with the building, but it wasn't the most practical buildings.
And that was Pringle Brandon.
It was Pringle Brandon. Exactly.
Yeah.
So they had maybe four floors in there.
Right.
Then, you know, as the firm moved away from a pure sort of corporate interiors practice, which it was mainly, once you start adding in the master planning, some healthcare into there as well, then the architectural team of John Drew, you know, we ran out of space.
Right.
And so what happened then was we started expanding and taking space in adjacent buildings. And so I think we had three locations at one point.
And that's quite hard, I guess, to build corporate identity.
It's hard to build a culture if people can't spend time with other people and have the informal sort of interactions, the coffee points or wherever it is, you don't even know who your team members are.
No.
So we needed to have the space like this. And sort of links back to your point that we are a big international firm, so we do need to have a presence which sort of reflects that.
Yeah.
We need to have all the facilities that we need to perform, the model making facilities, the sort of the proper client suites.
Yeah.
So we did have to move, and I think it's been massively successful. We've broken down a lot of the silos and the barriers between teams.
Yeah.
We've got plenty of space for expansion, which we want to do. Obviously, we want to grow.
It feels quite luxurious in here in terms
exactly.
of space and things.
Well, I think as a managing director, I look at space and think, well, that's costing money, so we need to fill that with our team members.
People, yeah,
exactly. But we do want to grow. I mean, that's definitely the plan.
That's
London, London's one of the capital. It is one of the capital design cities of the world.
Yeah.
You know, I think London, New York, maybe LA.
Yeah.
These are the big hubs that we, as a group, see as the powerhouses of what we do. There's so much talent in London that we want to harness that. I think that's my remit, is to come and grow the office and sort of take it forward.
It's maybe relatively rare then that we hear the kind of such clear business. You know, talk to a number of, for the podcast, a number of principals, and a lot of the time they talk about new projects or about this, but very rarely is there a clear, defined goal.
Yeah.
Growing a practice.
Yeah.
That's quite a
It's different. I think I enjoy doing that.
Yeah,
In reality, that's my passion. I love growing businesses.
Yeah.
And you know, even though we have 140 staff, it still feels like a new practice for me because I didn't know these people. So on the first few months, I'd be at events and somebody would come and say hello and say, oh, by the way, I work for you. Apologies. There's quite a lot of names. And as long as I can remember their faces now, I'm quite happy.
Right.
But yeah, I think it probably is quite unique, I think, in terms of some of the architectural practices, even the larger ones. I think larger architectural firms are already at a certain size. They've already grown.
Yeah.
But we haven't done that yet.
Yeah.
So that's what we want to do.
Do you think there's something then about ambition within a practice? I mean, you see some organisations who are clearly on a, think about kind of big old organisations, maybe they know they're on a sort of downward trajectory or doing that kind of affect staff. But when staff hear that you're ambitious and growing, do you think that kind of just affects the way people...
It does.
Yeah, kind of walk with a bit more of a swagger, really.
I think they know. One thing that's important is everybody within the practice understands what the strategy is.
Mm.
I think that's really, really important. I think if it's just a strategy that's in my head and I don't tell anybody, then it's not a strategy.
Yeah.
It's basically a dream. So, yeah, I think I'm spending a lot of time right now sort of doing lots of town halls, you know, lots of messaging, and lots of one-on-one meetings and group meetings so that people really understand what we're trying to achieve.
Yeah.
Because we can't do that unless we have everybody going in the same direction.
Yeah.
And that's not just the principals and the leadership. It's it's everybody, you know, from reception all the way through the business.
Yeah. That's fascinating. That's really... And then interested in some of the kind of projects. It's interesting, I mean, jumping back, just looking at the list of buildings in Chicago that Perkins and Will have.
Yes, there's a big legacy there.
I mean, it's actually the whole of Chicago, downtown Chicago. But then looking on at kind of some of your London, kind of UK projects run, I guess.
Yes.
So, I mean, jumping around a bit now, but your London office then, you're obviously running projects across the UK.
Yes.
But more broadly, looking your kind of remit across Europe.
Europe as well.
Yeah.
I think... Definitely looking at Europe. Yeah. I think my vision and my plan is I want us to be a strong architectural firm in London, then in the UK, and then into Europe.
Okay.
I think if we're strong in our core base,
and
we can expand outwards. There's obviously challenges with working in Europe and elsewhere in the UK. Given we're in central London, our overhead's going to be higher. You know, we have to pay higher salaries.
Yeah.
So we have to be quite selective on the projects that we go for. And the clients have to be in tune with that sort of, that level of service, I guess.
Yeah.
And many are, but it's just an understanding. And the same in Europe. I mean, there's plenty of countries with great architects in Europe, and they're going to cost a lot less than us.
Yeah.
So the question is, you know, why are we best aligned to work with that client?
Yeah.
So that's the sort of discussions that we have to have.
And that's for them around risk and about kind of understanding of
exactly.
client and
about
expertise
and you know, you know, if you want to do an amazing hospital with all the best technology and the latest equipment, there's probably only a few practices that can actually do that who've done it before.
Okay, that's interesting. The kind of healthcare, we might come on to the kind of healthcare question a little bit later.
That's quite
a technical and quite a kind
it
of,
is.
So, I mean, some of the other projects you're working on, I mean, some of the things like the Siemens Crystal, which was two, three years ago, maybe.
I think it was, yes. We did the interiors on that one as well, yes.
And, I mean, that's, in a sense, interesting then. A lot of the, so the News UK building, you've done the interiors there.
Yes.
That is interesting how a practice works on the interiors of a building. Mm. They've not maybe necessarily worked on the whole...
The whole
building. Yeah, I'd be interested just to hear about how you kind of. I mean,
I've been thinking about this quite a lot recently.
Yeah.
That, and I think, in terms of building a practice. So, you know, if you're building an architectural firm or an interiors firm, looking back, to build an interiors firm is quicker.
Mm.
It probably takes about 5 years to build up the firm, design, win work, design it, have it delivered. Have a couple of projects and then a reputation. I think for architecture, it takes longer. So architecture, you know, we started, John Drew came across probably about 7 years ago, the same time as I joined the firm, actually, within a few months. But to build architecture, to build a practice, you need finished work. Mm. So to have finished work means that you have to, it takes some time. So I think we now have a project in Cambridge, which is complete. So I think we put it up for a few awards this year. We have the stage, which is a sort of a residential mixed-use development
in Shoreditch.
Yeah. Exactly.
That's complete now, is it?
Not complete, but it's coming out of the ground.
Okay.
So I go past that every few days, and it's moving on, which is great. And obviously, there's sort of the Shakespeare Theatre in that in the ground that we found.
Okay.
So you really need, in reality, 10 years to build up an architectural practice.
Yeah.
There's no quick way of doing it.
Okay.
I think in Dubai it can be a bit quicker, but you know, we started the architectural practice 5 years ago, and we're only just probably this year having finished buildings. Yeah. So it's sort of 6 to 7 years, whereas in London probably about 10 years in reality.
And particularly, I guess, growing a practice that does work at that scale.
Yes.
So, you know,
you could do smaller residential stuff and you could do it quickly.
And you haven't got a team here doing people's extensions for So it is about those big...
It's bigger projects.
Yeah.
And I think, look, if you were setting up an architectural practice in London and it was you and your friends, you would be doing the extensions, you'd be doing, you know, you'd do some houses and so, whatever you would do, you'd build it up that way. But for a firm of our size, it makes no sense for us to do that sort of work.
No.
Yeah, we have to do these big projects.
Okay. And so other kind of fit-out, I mean, the Economist have just moved from their Smithson building in St. James.
Yeah.
That was the kind of fit-out for them. It's quite, I mean, interior design, the kind of understanding of how a business functions.
Mm. The psychology of the business.
Must be really interesting, actually.
Yeah.
Wondering out loud whether that's kind of connected really to the kind of management in terms of, you know, you can build a big, you know, architects can design a big building, but it's really in the kind of functioning of the interiors.
It's a very humanistic aspect of it.
How a business works.
Yeah.
And maybe that's the kind of interest that you develop then in the business.
I think it probably is, And it's almost, you're an actor, you know, and you're going to act in their movie. So you have to understand how they work, and you have to start thinking like they think, and you have to understand, you know what their frustrations are, and you know, just because it's the Economist, they are different from their rival publications.
Yeah.
You know, you might just assume things, but the DNA is different, as in any business. So there's a lot of time there's a lot of time spent with the clients, really trying to figure out who they really are, and what they really, really want. Because often people say something that they want, but actually that's not what they want.
They just don't know
how to communicate that with you.
Yeah. Okay. And then we talked a little bit about healthcare, which I guess as people are experiencing a hospital, probably doesn't come into the architecture of the building, kind of quite a technical and quite a kind of...
I think there's two ways of doing healthcare. There's you can design a hospital led by the medical planner, or you can, there's three ways, or you can design a hospital led by the architect. Yeah. What you should do is have the medical planner and the architect work together to design a hospital. I think that's when you get a successful solution. You know, I've seen plenty of hospitals that maybe look good, but they don't function very well. So that's the big challenge. And obviously the UK, you know, I think we all know it's got issues with the service. I think we all want to have the NHS, but how the model goes in the future, you know, we've got an older population, we've got all these challenges from finances, you know, the medication costs more, the treatment's more expensive, the equipment's more expensive. So I think there's going to be a change in how we deliver this. And I think, you know, in reality, the US is probably further afield than anyone else in terms of the in terms of medicine, in terms of, you know, the equipment and the sort of the facilities.
And how much then does that, I mean, thinking about kind of the... You're thinking about growing the business over, you know, 10, 20 years.
Yeah.
The kind of change of the profession over that time.
Yes.
I just wonder how much sort of research and future thinking kind of goes on then within a practice of this kind of size.
We have a lot. We actually have research labs, and they're paid for by the whole firm.
Yeah.
And there's different sort of, I guess, subjects within each of those, and we publish them. So I think, you know, we're looking into the sort of, we have a neuroscientist working in one of our labs at the moment, trying to look at sort of evidence-based design.
Yeah.
In many ways, you know, can we can we prove that our healthcare facilities make patients healthier, or can we prove that they save lives? So obviously it's data, it's analytics, but once you start gathering that data and, you know, all this thing about sort of the big cloud or whatever it is, how do we utilize that data to influence our design?
Yeah.
So I think that's the type of thing that we're looking at the moment. And it might sound quite dry, but actually in buildings where the function like that is massively important, you almost can't get it wrong. You shouldn't get it wrong.
Yeah.
You should use all the previous knowledge that you have to deliver something that's exceptional and helps people, helps humans.
Yeah. I guess then some of that, there must be a balance between how much of the research you do in practice you keep, in a sense, as kind of corporate wisdom, you kind of keep to yourself.
We try and publish it. We publish annually. We make it available to everyone. So, I think by being thought leaders, by telling people what we do, we talk about it, other people can join into it as well.
Yeah.
I think big practices have to do that.
Yeah.
And we have to share it with smaller practices
because
they just haven't got the capacity to do that.
Yeah.
And it's not something that they can compete with us on these huge hospitals. They can't, but they can at least look at that data and make informed decisions by it.
Yeah. And then maybe thinking about the future in London.
Yes.
And about, so you're in this office now for...
We're going to be stuck here for a while.
For a while.
Yeah. Exactly.
We talked a bit then about growth and about kind of future projects.
Yes. The big piece for us right now... it's a perceptual piece that Jack and the team have built up an amazingly strong corporate interiors practice.
Yeah.
And everybody knows Jack Pringle, everybody knows that Pringle Brandon are corporate interiors.
Yeah.
So how do we move away from that and be a fully fledged architecture and design firm?
Yeah.
We still always will do corporate interiors, but we have to define who we are and the perception of us in London.
Yeah.
So that's the sort of the big focus right now. It's a perception and sort of messaging piece that we're looking at, because we have the talent, and we have the resources and everything else, and we're having projects now as well, so we can talk about these things. We just had the 150 Holborn project, which is sort of our parent company's office in Holborn, which is through planning now as well. So it's all these little bits and pieces.
Will the plan be eventually then that you will...
That's the plan, but like we said, London takes ages to build anything, so it's a bit down the line.
And now we'll start just kind of starting to round up. I mean, when you first... Your contacts, I guess, that you've built up in Dubai, you're back, in a sense, not quite to square one, because there's existing relationships.
But I'm pretty much back to square one.
So you're out spending, kind of meeting those clients against the City of London and the other kind of big influential
and trying to understand how the dynamics work and what the connections are and how is this company connected to that company and the people. It's quite interesting. I knew that was going to happen, and I think if I was in Dubai and I was 10 years older, would I have come back to try to do this? Probably not.
Okay.
Because it's tough.
Yeah.
But I felt I was young enough to start again and have a go at this. And, I know what I have to do.
Yeah.
It's a big challenge. It's completely new.
I mean, I'm interested that the kind of ambassadors, I guess, are the other people who get moved around the world kind of... on purpose, really, that they don't keep people in place for too long, that there is something about bringing new people in to make new relationships over again, and that's quite an interesting kind of process, really, about re-establishing.
Some people like that, and some people don't like it. Yeah, some people don't like change.
We're talking earlier about that attitude to change. And then being new to London again, you've obviously been here before, but in terms of things then that might... inspire you around the city, or things you might find kind of interesting, or for people to listening to look at, to get inspired by what.
It's the smallest of things. It's being able to walk around the city is amazing. It's really small. So I took my daughters to Borough Market at the weekend, and we walked across the bridge, and we went up to sort of St Paul's, and you just can't do that in Dubai.
No.
So it's been sort of part of
because
a part
of the scale
of a city.
And because of the
structure's not there. The infrastructure, you're just not meant to walk.
Okay.
We often had sort of guests come across from the US or the UK and Dubai, and you know, they would arrive at the meeting just drenched in sweat
because they
thought they could walk. Yeah, exactly. You can't.
No. Okay.
So yeah, small things like that are amazing. And the culture. I mean, I've been to probably, I don't know, 3 or 4 different sort of theatre shows. We've been to the ballet. We've been to the opera. And again, you just can't do that. So that's amazing.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of shiny new buildings, we've got lots of those in Dubai, so it's not really—it's not really about that.
Yeah.
I think the
it's almost the kind of intangible.
It's intangible. It's walking around. It's walking around cities. It's seeing graffiti on walls.
Yeah.
Small things. You just don't really the smell sometimes.
Yeah.
The smell of a city. You know, it's the same in New York. When you walk around, there's a smell, and it's the steam coming up from the drains.
Yeah.
It's intangible, but it's...
You know where you are.
Where you are, and it makes you feel like you're part of something bigger, I guess, as well.
And are there other cities, then, that you find that you kind of like for that?
I love New York.
Yeah.
New York's amazing. I really like... Weirdly, I like D.C. That's where my wife's from, so I spend a lot of time there, and... really like it. It's quite quiet. My wife explained it that, you know, New York is a bit like Dubai and DC is a bit like Abu Dhabi. So all the power and the sort of the wealth is actually in DC, but all the fun and the glamour is actually in New York. So that was very similar.
Okay. There's something about cities. I mean, a number of people have said about needing their kind of gritty edge and they're too sanitized and too...
Yeah. I think you need that. Yeah. I mean, like, Tokyo is amazing, but it's a little bit sanitized, weirdly.
Yeah. That's great. We've covered so much there.
That was
Thank
fun.
Thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
It's a real insight into a very different practice.
You've been listening to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture. On the programme this week was Stephen Charlton. You can find out more about Stephen and his work at architecturemasters.org. From where you can also subscribe to the podcast and follow us on Twitter. You can send any comments, questions or suggestions by email to hello@architecturemasters.org. If you've enjoyed the programme, why not leave a review or a rating with your podcast provider, as this helps others to discover the programme. This has been Architecture Masters. I'm Owen Wainhouse. Thank you for listening.